I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
You know, we often think about the what of pesticides, what chemical, what pest, what target.
Mm-hmm.
But how often do we really stop and think about the how? You know, the actual mechanics of getting that product from the jug onto the plant or into the soil.
It seems pretty straightforward sometimes, doesn't it? Like you pour liquid in, you spray it out.
Yeah.
But there's actually a surprising amount of engineering and material science and just plain precision involved in making sure that happens safely and effectively.
Exactly. And if that whole system isn't working perfectly, the entire effort can kind of fail or be wasteful or worse, cause, you know, unintended environmental issues.
Absolutely.
So today we're doing a deep dive into the nuts and bolts, literally, of pesticide application equipment.
And our guide for this deep dive is quite a detailed text. It really walks us through the different equipment types, the application methods, and crucially, the maintenance practices needed to put pesticides exactly where they need to go.
So our mission, to cut through some of the technical jargon, pull out the essential bits of knowledge you need. We want you to understand the different types of gear, how they actually function, why choosing the right components is so critical, how to spot wear and tear before it becomes a big problem, and really what it takes to keep it all running smoothly. Okay, let's unpack this.
All right. So let's start with probably the most common type you'll encounter, liquid application equipment. Basically, at its core, it uses either hydraulic pressure or sometimes air to break up the liquid into droplets and then move them onto the target.
And these can range quite a bit, right? From small hand-operated sprayers all the way up to large powered systems you see on tractors or even aircraft.
Exactly. And they all share some basic parts that have to work together. You've got the tank, obviously, to hold the mixture.
Right.
A pump, which is key for creating the necessary pressure. And then critical components like the nozzles. They're responsible for actually breaking up the spray, directing it, and regulating the flow rate. Super important.
You also mentioned things like filters or strainers,
yeah.
to keep gunk out.
Yeah, foreign particles, and a pressure gauge to see what the system's doing. Plus, often you'll find other pieces like fans for air assistance, pressure regulators, various valves, maybe agitators, to keep the product mixed properly in the tank.
Wow.
And of course, the booms or hand spray guns that actually direct the spray onto the target.
It really is a system.
Yeah.
And the guide we're using points out something really important. You can often swap out or adjust many of these parts depending on, you know, what you're spraying, the specific pest, or even the weather conditions.
That's a key point for flexibility. Mm. But the flip side is, if any part gets worn or damaged, the text stresses it needs to be replaced immediately. You can't just ignore wear in one component because it can throw off the whole system.
Right. It cascades.
Absolutely. And just recognizing that wear is so key to maintaining accuracy and, frankly, preventing problems down the road. Let's maybe look at some of the main components and the specific signs of wear the text highlights.
Okay, yeah. Tanks seem like a good place to start. The source talks about different materials, stainless steel, fiberglass, and thermoplastic.
Right. Stainless steel is generally excellent for resisting rust and corrosion with most pesticides, but it's usually the most expensive option.
Uh-huh.
You still need to check them regularly for any signs of rust or corrosion starting.
Yeah.
And if it's a coated tank, you got to watch for scratches or chips that expose the metal underneath because those spots can start to corrode. Usually, a skilled tech can repair them, though.
Okay. What about fiberglass?
Fiberglass tanks are strong, pretty durable, and small damaged areas are relatively easy to repair. But T, and this is a really crucial point from the text, you have to inspect fiberglass very carefully for scratches or abrasions.
Why is that?
Because unlike other materials, fiberglass can actually absorb the pesticide mixture into those damaged spots.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which can potentially lead to contamination of future mixes, even if you think you've cleaned it thoroughly.
So that residue stays trapped in the fiberglass itself.
Kind of, yeah, in those damaged fibers. That absorption risk is a key difference. Now, thermoplastic tanks, they're lightweight, quite durable, but they can soften or deform if they get really hot.
Okay.
The text notes that scratches on thermoplastic don't carry that same absorption risk as fiberglass, which is good. However, punctures or cracks are generally harder to repair in thermoplastic, and the material itself can degrade over time from sun and weather exposure.
Is there a clear sign for that degradation?
Yes, actually. Here's a really specific sign of where to watch for on thermoplastic tanks.
Mm.
The text calls it spiderwebbing.
Spiderwebbing.
Yeah, it looks like small interconnected cracks, almost like a spider's web across the surface. It shows the material is weakening. If you see that distinctive pattern, the tank is losing its structural integrity, and it really needs to be replaced. It's a very clear visual warning.
Huh. Good to know. Easy to spot once you know what you're looking for, I guess.
It is. Okay, moving on to pumps. These are absolutely vital for creating the system pressure needed. And there are different types, each with their own wear characteristics.
Right.
Diaphragm pumps are quite popular. They tend to handle abrasive and corrosive materials well.
Why is that?
Well, because generally only the chemical-resistant diaphragm and maybe some valves actually contact the liquid. This reduces wear on the other moving parts. They're also relatively simple to maintain, which is a plus.
Is there a common failure sign for those?
Yeah, a real telltale sign of a diaphragm leak in this type of pump is if you see milky-looking oil in the pump's oil reservoir. That means spray mixture is getting past the diaphragm and mixing with the pump oil. Not good. Also, something to watch out for. If you're using pesticides that contain petroleum-based solvents, they can accelerate the breakdown of rubber diaphragms and valves.
Good tip. What other pump types are common?
Roller pumps are typically the least expensive option. They work using these rollers spinning inside a housing. Because of that design, they are subject to considerable wear, especially from abrasive stuff like wettable powders.
Makes sense.
Rollers made of rubber tend to last longer with non-abrasive liquids. But, and this is important, you must use nylon or Teflon rollers, specifically if you're spraying petroleum-based pesticides like oils or emulsions.
Why the specific materials?
Because petroleum just deteriorates rubber pretty quickly. The good news is the rollers themselves are usually quite easy to replace when they get worn.
Okay. Then you have piston pumps.
Right. Piston pumps are generally the most expensive type. You often need them for really high-pressure applications or for sprayers that have rate controllers that adjust pressure automatically.
How do they work?
Basically, pistons force the fluid through one-way valves. This action can sometimes create a pulsating pressure in the spray line. So some systems use what's called a surge tank to even that pressure out.
And wear.
Abrasive chemicals definitely cause wear here, too. But the more expensive piston pumps often feature stainless steel or even ceramic liners inside to resist that wear much more effectively.
Gotcha. One more type.
Centrifugal pumps. These are often heavy-duty, pretty adaptable, made from various metals or plastics. They're particularly good with abrasive materials.
Oh, why is that?
Because there's no close contact between the moving parts. It's a high-speed impeller that creates the pumping action. So abrasives don't grind things down as much. They're often relatively easy to repair, and you see them a lot in high-volume air blast sprayers, like the ones used in orchards or vineyards.
Okay. The guide also mentions mechanical agitators, right, for keeping things mixed.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are used to keep wettable powders and other formulations from settling out in the tank. They do need maintenance, especially where the drive shafts pass through the tank wall.
Weeks.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Packings and grease fittings are used to prevent leaks there, but they need periodic servicing and tightening. The text recommends using marine-grade grease specifically. And of course, you also need to service any belts or chains that power the agitator itself.
Right. Okay, what about filters and screens? Seems simple but important. Simple but essential. They're there to remove foreign particles before they get to the pump, or, critically, the nozzles. A really common sign that your screens are getting clogged is if you notice the pressure dropping unexpectedly or maybe unusual strain on the pump.
Where are they usually located?
The text recommends having strainers before the pump, sometimes after the pump as well, and always, always right before the nozzles. Like a little screen in the nozzle body itself.
And size matters here.
Definitely. It's important to use the correct screen mesh size for your specific nozzle type. You can usually find this info in the nozzle manufacturer's catalog. But here's a really crucial point the text emphasizes. If you find you're getting excessive plugging, don't just take the screens out.
Tempting, maybe. Very tempting. But while a clogged screen is annoying, it actually means it's doing its job. Removing them just increases wear on your pump and nozzles downstream, and you'll end up with plugged nozzles anyway, which messes up your application. You need to troubleshoot and fix the cause of the plugging, like checking if your water source is dirty or maybe not cleaning your nozzles properly.
So really understanding these specific wear signs for each component, like where to look, what to watch for, that milky oil in the diaphragm pump or the spider webbing on a plastic tank. It isn't just about knowing how to fix things when they break, is it?
Not at all.
Yeah.
It's really about preventing problems before they happen. It ensures the pesticide is applied accurately, and ultimately it saves you time and money by avoiding costly repairs or, worse, ineffective applications because the gear wasn't working right.
It really does show how much attention to detail is needed just to keep the delivery system itself working correctly. Now, speaking of critical components, what piece do you think is most sensitive? The one that can mess up the whole job the fastest if it's not right.
That would almost certainly have to be the nozzle.
Yes, the nozzle. Often called the heart of the sprayer, and for good reason, it sounds like. The text makes it clear these are way more than just simple spray tips.
Oh, absolutely. Nozzles are really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, or maybe where the liquid meets the air. They determine pretty much everything.
Like what?
Like the droplet pattern, the actual size of the droplets, how uniform the spray coverage is, how well you cover the target, and critically important nowadays, the potential for spray drift.
Right.
All of those factors directly impact how effective the application is, how much product you end up using, which hits your wallet, and of course, its environmental impact.
And the tech says all nozzles wear out eventually, regardless of what they're made of.
Yep, all materials wear. And the text really stresses that worn nozzles lead to improper spray patterns, incorrect flow rates, uneven coverage across the boom, and unpredictable droplet sizes.
So you might think you're spraying evenly, but you're actually getting streaks or gaps.
Exactly. Imagine looking at what should be a solid wall of spray coming from a boom, but instead you see clear gaps or streaks where certain nozzles just aren't performing correctly. That's the kind of patchy, uneven coverage worn nozzles cause. The text even provides some figures showing just how bad it can look.
What makes them wear out faster?
Several things influence nozzle wear. The nozzle design itself and the material it's made from, obviously. The spray material's liquids that contain solids, like wettable powders or suspensions with crystals, cause significantly more wear than clear solutions.
Makes sense. More abrasive.
Right. Spray pressure is a big one. Too high a pressure generally means faster wear. Interestingly, the text notes that the sharp edges on, say, a flat fan nozzle tend to wear faster initially than the rounder openings on something like a flooding tip.
Huh.
Also, larger nozzle orifices tend to wear slower than smaller ones, just due to the flow dynamics. And even small changes in the pesticide formulation itself can sometimes affect how quickly a nozzle wears.
So how do you know when it's actually time to replace them? Is there a rule of thumb?
The guide is pretty specific here. You should replace nozzles when they fail to deliver the accurate amount of product or they don't produce the desired pattern anymore. A good practical rule of thumb is to replace all the nozzles on a boom if the output from any single nozzle varies by more than 10% from the average output of a brand new nozzle of the same size and type.
10%.
Oh. And to ensure you get uniform wear across the entire boom, it's really best practice to use nozzles made of the same material all the way across.
Speaking of materials, that seems like another key choice. Cost versus durability, I imagine.
Exactly that trade-off.
Yeah.
Brass is relatively inexpensive, but it wears quickly from abrasion. It might be acceptable if you're only using non-abrasive sprays, or maybe if you plan to replace your nozzles very frequently anyway.
Okay, what's more durable?
Stainless steel resists corrosion and abrasion quite well. Hardened stainless steel wears exceptionally well, but it's also more expensive. The source also mentions plastic nozzles that have stainless steel inserts. That's kind of a middle ground, offering improved wear resistance compared to solid plastic, but at a lower cost than solid stainless steel.
What about other metals? Like aluminum?
Materials like aluminum and Mon-El, which is a nickel alloy, they do resist corrosion well. But duty, the guide warns they are highly susceptible to abrasion, because they're relatively soft metals.
Mm.
You should generally avoid these unless you have a very specific, unusual corrosion issue where maybe other materials just won't work.
Gotcha. And plastic?
Solid plastic is usually the least expensive, and it resists corrosion well, but it can sometimes swell when it's exposed to certain organic solvents found in some pesticides. It also generally has low abrasion resistance, so it's typically recommended only with selected pesticides. And again, like with stainless, you can get plastic nozzles with stainless steel inserts, which gives you better wear resistance and also helps reduce that swelling problem.
Okay. What's the top tier for durability?
For the ultimate resistance to both abrasion and corrosion, you're looking at tungsten carbide, or ceramic. These materials are used for high-pressure and highly abrasive spray applications.
Sounds expensive.
They can be, yeah. Which is why you often find them as inserts set into brass or plastic bodies that helps reduce the overall cost. Ceramic inserts, in particular, are relatively affordable now and they last a long time. But T, there's a key drawback mentioned in the guide.
Oh!
They're quite fragile. Ceramic can easily crack if you over-tighten it during installation. That's something you definitely need to be careful about. Don't wrench down on it too hard.
Good warning. So selecting the right nozzle isn't just about the material. It's also about the pattern and the droplet size needed for the specific job, right?
Absolutely. The guide provides...
Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Provides a pretty extensive overview of all the different types available.
What's the most common type people might see?
For most ground applications, like spraying in row crops or maybe targeting weeds between rows, the tapered flat spray pattern nozzle is probably the most common type used.
But there's a huge variety beyond that.
Oh, huge. Just looking at the examples the text provides in a table, you see all sorts of flat fan patterns, like even spray, off-center, low-pressure, extended-range versions. Then you have cone patterns, both hollow cone and solid cone. Turbulence chamber designs like flood nozzles or flat patterns from those, and then others like solid stream nozzles, broadcast nozzles, and the more specialized air injection or air induction nozzles, sometimes called Venturi nozzles.
Wow. And each one has a specific purpose.
Exactly. For instance, an even flat fan gives you a uniform distribution right across its fan width. It's used for applications where you don't want overlap, like spraying a band directly over a crop row. Typically runs at lower pressures, like 20-40 PSI.
Okay.
A low-pressure flat fan, on the other hand, is designed for overlapping swaths, like broadcast spraying, and works well in maybe the 20-60 PSI range. If you need really fine droplets to penetrate dense foliage, maybe an air blast sprayer, a hollow cone nozzle is often used, usually at higher pressures, say 40-120 PSI.
What about reducing drift?
Right. If you need coarser droplets, specifically to reduce drift, a turbulence flood nozzle is one option. It uses lower pressure, maybe 520 PSI, but it requires about 50% overlap between the spray patterns to get even coverage. And then those air injection or Venturi nozzles are specifically designed to pull air into the liquid stream.
How does that help?
It creates much larger air-filled droplets, very coarse droplets, that are significantly less prone to drifting off target. They typically operate at pressures of 40-50 PSI or even higher.
The guide also has something about standardizing droplet sizes.
Yes, very helpful. It includes a chart that standardizes droplet size categories. It uses symbols and even color codes. You can think of it like a spectrum, ranging from extremely fine mist, which is very small droplets that drift easily, all the way up to ultra coarse, which are very large droplets that resist drift much better. It gives the micron ranges for each category.
So that chart helps you choose.
It's a crucial tool, yeah, for selecting a nozzle that produces the optimal droplet size for your particular application, trying to balance the need for good coverage on the target with the need to minimize off-target drift. A micron, by the way, is incredibly small, 1/1000th of a meter. So we're talking about tiny variations having big impacts.
Wow. What's fascinating here is just how much science and detailed consideration goes into this one single piece of equipment, the nozzle.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly not just a simple hole drilled in metal or plastic. It's a precisely engineered component, and it directly impacts safety, effectiveness, and the environmental outcome. Choosing the wrong nozzle or just using a worn-out one can completely compromise the entire application, even if you did everything else perfectly.
Absolutely. It really makes you appreciate the skill involved in just selecting and managing this seemingly small but critical part of the system.
Okay, so now that we've gone pretty deep on the components, especially that critical nozzle, let's maybe shift gears a bit and talk about the many different ways pesticides are actually applied, the various methods, and how the equipment is matched up to them.
Right. The guide really emphasizes that the specific application method chosen is highly dependent on, well, the pest itself. The site where it's located. Is it a field, an orchard, indoors?
Yeah.
And the specific target within that site. The text outlines quite a variety of methods used in different situations.
Let's maybe walk through a few key examples from the guide. Banned and directed spraying, you mentioned that for row crops.
Yeah, common in row crops or maybe non-crop areas like roadside rights of way. The big benefit there is using significantly less pesticide because you're targeting only a specific narrow band or directing the spray right at the base of the plants. That reduces cost and environmental load.
Any drawbacks?
A potential drawback is that it requires specialized equipment and really careful setup. And if a nozzle on the boom twists even slightly out of alignment, it can mess up the uniform band and potentially cause drift where you don't want it. Equipment here is typically hydraulic sprayers, boom sprayers, or sometimes specific granule spreaders designed for banding.
Okay. What about spot treatments?
Spot treatments are used for specific pests found only in smaller defined areas. Think like treating individual livestock animals, or weeds popping up in an orchard or vineyard, or maybe scattered weed patches in a larger field, or hitting early pest infestations before they spread.
Big benefit there seems obvious targeted.
Hugely beneficial for targeting. You can reach tough spots, keep the pesticide right on the target, and it offers really significant pesticide reduction. The text mentions often 70% to even 90% less product used compared to just broadcasting over the whole area.
Any downsides?
A potential drawback, especially with handheld applications, is that maintaining a perfectly steady walking pace can be difficult on uneven terrain. And the volume you apply might vary slightly from spot to spot, which could lead to slightly uneven coverage if you're not careful.
And the equipment for spot treatment sounds like it could be pretty varied.
Very varied. Anything from simple handheld trigger spray guns, all sorts of backpack or knapsack sprayers, maybe wheelbarrow sprayers for slightly larger jobs, estate sprayers, even things like rope wick or wiper applicators can be used for spot treating weeds.
Then there's precision or patch spraying. Sounds similar to spot.
It is similar, used for those early or localized infestations or weed patches. But this typically involves more advanced technology. We're talking about using GPS and rate controllers on the sprayer.
Ah, the VRA systems.
Exactly, variable rate application systems. These allow you to accurately target very precise areas based on a pre-programmed map of where the pests or weeds actually are. The system automatically turns nozzles on or off or adjusts the rate as you drive across the field.
Same benefit of reduction.
Yeah, again, that significant 70% to 90% pesticide reduction because you're only treating exactly where needed. The main drawbacks are the high upfront cost of the system controllers and the GPS units, the need for some programming knowledge to create the application maps, and potentially more complex maintenance.
And the equipment is typically boom sprayers set up with that VRA technology, or maybe specialized spinning disc or drizzle applicators for really controlled droplet sizes.
Correct. Then there's basal application. This is a very targeted method, usually for treating weeds or maybe insects specifically right at the base of trees or vines, or for removing unwanted woody brush or trees.
Benefit is extreme targeting.
Exactly. Highly targeted with minimal risk of damage to surrounding desirable plants. And for woody plants, applying a systemic pesticide to the base allows it to move throughout the entire plant for better control. Drawbacks can include it not being very effective if the bark is wet from rain, potential for applicator exposure since you're working close to the ground, and the effectiveness can sometimes depend on the air temperature and the age or thickness of the bark you're treating. Equipment can range from simple syringe or trigger pump sprayers to low-volume backpack sprayers, or even wick applicators just dabbing the base.
Okay, moving to the other extreme, broadcast application.
Right. This is used for covering larger areas, especially where you have dense foliage or maybe high pest populations spread across the whole area. Think animal orchards, large pastures, or maybe fields with widespread disease or insect pressure.
Benefits seem like coverage and efficiency.
Generally, yeah. Good penetration and coverage in dense plant canopies or maybe thick animal hair. Large tanks on broadcast sprayers can cover many acres efficiently, and it's generally a versatile method. The significant drawbacks, though, are a higher potential for drift, especially if you need smaller droplets for good coverage. You can get uneven deposit depending on wind and other site conditions. It can potentially waste pesticide if the pest isn't actually uniformly distributed across the whole area. And it typically uses a lot more water, power, and fuel compared to those targeted methods.
And the equipment is quite varied, too.
Very. Backpack mist blowers, large air blast sprayers common in orchards, oscillating boom sprayers, high-pressure hydraulic sprayers, even specialized air assist or electrostatic sprayers designed to improve coverage. And of course, various spreaders or power dusters if you're applying dry formulations broadcast.
What about rope wick or wiper methods? Seems specialized.
They are quite specialized, yeah. particularly useful for controlling weeds that are taller than your desirable crop, especially where drift is a major concern, or sometimes for applying products to control external parasites on livestock.
The benefit is drift reduction.
Primarily, yes. Extremely reduced drift. Because the pesticide is applied directly by contact, it literally wipes onto the target plant or animal. This allows very selective application of broad-spectrum herbicides just to the weeds sticking up above the crop. And for livestock, you can set up self-applicator devices where the animals are automatically treated as they rub against the wick or wiper.
Clever. Drawbacks.
For wick applicators, you need to constantly monitor the wick itself to make sure it's not oversaturated and dripping, but also not too dry to be effective. Wicks can also collect dirt and dust, which makes them less effective over time. And for weed control, obviously, the weed must be taller than the desirable plant for it to work selectively. Animals might also need a bit of training to get used to using the self-applicators.
And the gear is basically variations on wicks and wipers.
Pretty much. Various rope wick or canvas wiper setups, either carried by hand or mounted on vehicles. And for animals, devices like face rubbers, back rubbers, treated cables they walk under, or even dust bags or boxes they have to contact.
Okay, how about dip, pour on, or spray dip methods?
These are often used for treating plant parts, like roots or seedlings, to manage disease, insects, or nematodes before transplanting them. Or, very commonly, for applying products to control external parasites on livestock.
Benefits seem clear targeted treatment.
Yeah, benefits include preventing pest spread via infested soil or plants. There's potential for mechanization, especially in nurseries, which can reduce worker exposure and increase efficiency. It's highly targeted to specific plant parts or, for animals, the entire surface. Complete immersion in a dip ensures thorough treatment for livestock, while pour-ons are very convenient and generally have low applicator exposure risk.
Downsides.
Potential drawbacks include the expense and time commitment involved in setting up large dipping vats or systems. The guide notes that not all potential dip treatments have actually been proven effective. And there can be higher worker exposure risk if the dipping systems aren't properly mechanized or managed. Equipment ranges from large dipping vats to mechanical plant treatment systems or specialized spray dip machines for livestock.
One more major one, chemigation.
Right, chemigation. That's the application of pesticides through an existing irrigation system. It's used for managing weeds, insects, or pathogens in large areas, often before or after planting.
Big benefit is using infrastructure you already have.
That's a major one, yeah.
Yeah.
Utilizing existing irrigation infrastructure makes it highly efficient for treating large areas. Plus, modern control systems allow for very precise amounts of pesticide to be applied along with the irrigation water.
Sounds good, but what are the catches?
The main drawbacks include the expense of the specialized injection equipment and safety backflow prevention devices required. These systems can be complex to design and manage correctly, and they must meet strict regulations designed to protect groundwater from contamination. And of course, you can get uneven application if the irrigation system itself is poorly maintained, or if the soil type isn't uniform across the field, leading to uneven water distribution.
And the equipment depends entirely on the irrigation type. Sprinkler, drip.
Exactly. The specific injection pumps, tanks, filters, and safety valves needed will depend heavily on whether it's a center pivot sprinkler, a drip system, flood irrigation, or something else.
Wow. Okay. If we kind of connect this all to the bigger picture, this incredible variety of application methods really underscores how pesticide application is such a highly specialized task. It's absolutely not just a simple spray everything approach.
Not at all.
The method chosen and the specific equipment matched to it are clearly fundamental decisions. They have to be based on the specific target organism, the environment it's in, the pest biology, and what outcome you're actually trying to achieve. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all situation.
And truly understanding that specialization is just crucial, both for maximizing the effectiveness of the treatment and for minimizing any unintended consequences on non-target organisms or the wider environment.
Absolutely. Which brings us perfectly to the final, really critical piece from the guide, keeping all this complex and varied equipment running properly and safely. Maintenance isn't just like recommended, the guide makes it sound absolutely essential.
Essential is the right word. The guide really emphasizes that regular inspections and just diligent maintenance aren't only about ensuring you get an effective application, they're absolutely critical for preventing accidents and spills. Things that can happen from, say, ruptured hoses, faulty fittings, or maybe damaged tanks failing.
So what's the basic protocol the guide suggests?
It's pretty straightforward, really. Inspect your equipment before each use. Look for any signs of wear, corrosion, or damage. Immediately replace or repair any faulty components you find. Don't put it off. Clean the equipment thoroughly after every application. Store it properly when it's not in use. And always, always wear the appropriate personal protective equipment, your PPE.
Right.
Like chemical-resistant rubber gloves and proper eye protection whenever you are cleaning or repairing equipment that has contained pesticides. Basic safety.
Okay. For liquid sprayers specifically, are there key preventive steps?
Yes. The guide highlights several key ones. First, using clean water is fundamental. Sand, silt, or other debris in your water source can cause rapid wear on pumps and nozzles, and it will quickly clog up your screens. The text is very clear. You must filter your water before it even goes into the spray tank.
Good point. Filter first.
Filter first. Also, it mentions checking your water's pH, because some pesticides can degrade rapidly if the water is too acidic or too alkaline. Though it notes that checking and adjusting pH is covered in more detail in another chapter.
Okay. What about those screens we talked about?
Keeping screens in place is also critical. Yes, they can get clogged, but like we discussed, that actually means they are doing their job by catching particles. Removing them because they're annoying just drastically increases wear on your pump and nozzles downstream. And you will inevitably end up with plugged nozzles anyway, which completely ruins your application accuracy. Use the proper size screen for your nozzles. And if you are getting excessive plugging, don't just remove the screen. Troubleshoot the root cause. Is your water source dirty? Are you maybe not cleaning the nozzles properly?
Speaking of cleaning nozzles, that sounds like it needs special care.
It does. Proper nozzle cleaning is absolutely non-negotiable. These are precision items. The guide gives a very strong warning here. Never use metal objects like wires, pocket knives, anything metal to try and clean out a nozzle opening.
Why not?
Because it will damage the precisely machined orifice. Even a tiny scratch can ruin the spray pattern and affect the flow rate.
Okay, no metal. Here's where it gets really interesting and maybe surprising for some. The guide explicitly warns never to blow through a nozzle with your mouth to clear blockage.
That's right. Huge safety risk there due to potentially ingesting pesticide residue. No mouth contact.
So how should you clean them?
Clean them by flushing with clean water, or maybe a detergent solution. Use a soft brush. They actually sell special soft-bristled nozzle cleaning brushes if particles are stuck. And if you absolutely must use compressed air, do it carefully and make sure you're wearing appropriate eye and skin protection. The text includes very clear visual warnings illustrating why you should avoid using metal objects or your mouth.
Got it. What else for liquid sprayers?
Flushing sprayers before use with clean water is also a good idea. It helps remove any manufacturing residue like metal chips or plastic shavings from brand new equipment, or maybe just dirt, leaves, rodent debris, or rust that might have accumulated during storage.
And cleaning after use sounds critical.
Absolutely essential. You must clean the sprayer thoroughly according to the label instructions, the last pesticide product you used in it.
Well, why follow the label?
Because different products might require different cleaning agents or procedures. Proper cleaning removes residues that could contaminate your next spray mix, which could potentially cause damage to a different sensitive crop or surface, or even just alter the efficacy of the new product you're trying to apply.
And leaving mixtures in the tank is a bad idea.
Very bad idea. The guide strongly advises against it. For one, prolonged contact can cause corrosion or deterioration of the tank materials and other components like seals or hoses. Also, many formulations, especially things like wettable powders, will settle out over time and become very difficult, maybe even impossible, to properly resuspend later. That leads to inconsistent application and plugging issues.
Okay.
Plus, some pesticides actually lose their effectiveness pretty rapidly once they're mixed in water. And maybe most importantly, an unattended sprayer just sitting there containing a pesticide mixture is a definite safety hazard.
Right. So what do you do with leftovers if you mix too much?
The best option, according to the guide, is always to apply any leftover spray mixture to an appropriate target site, following all the label directions. Just find more area that fits the label. If that's absolutely impossible, the guide states the leftover mixture must be treated as hazardous waste and disposed of properly at a permitted Class 1 disposal site that's facilities specifically licensed to handle that type of hazardous material. Can't just dump it.
Okay. And where should you do the cleaning?
The source gives important advice on this too. Ideally, if possible, clean and flush your sprayer right there in the field at the application site, assuming that site is an appropriate place to receive the small amount of residual pesticide in the wash water like it's labeled for that crop or area.
And if you can't clean in the field,
then you must contain the wash water, often using a concrete wash pad with a sump. You can sometimes use that contained wash water from cleaning for mixing other pesticides of the same type later on. But you need to be careful. Repeatedly cleaning in just one spot, even on a pad, can potentially cause contamination issues unless that wash water is fully contained and managed properly, perhaps treated or used as makeup water, according to regulations.
And extra cleaning if you switch products.
Definitely. If you're switching to a different type of pesticide for your next application, particularly if you were just using herbicides and now you're going to spray, say, an insecticide or fungicide on a sensitive crop, you need a much more thorough cleaning process. Check the pesticide label. It might specify particular tank cleaning agents or procedures required to remove all traces. The guide even suggests that for certain pesticides known to be particularly hard to clean out, especially some herbicides, it might be wise to consider using separate dedicated spray tanks just for those products to completely avoid the risk of carryover contamination.
Makes sense. Okay, what about maintenance for dust and granule applicators? Different process, I assume.
Equally important, but yeah, different specifics. The main thing is still to clean them thoroughly after each use to remove all leftover pesticide or residue. Lubricate components like chains or auger bearings, but only according to the manufacturer's instructions. And inspect them regularly for wear or corrosion, repairing any rusted areas promptly.
Any specifics for dust applicators?
For dusters, yeah. Inspect them before use to make sure the chamber is completely dry, moisture is bad for dusts, and check that any threads are clean. Make sure the tip is securely attached. Inspect the tips and any extensions for cracks or wear. Replace anything flawed. And importantly, dispose of worn-out dust applicators as contaminated items. Don't just toss them. After use, clean them using something like a nylon brush, maybe soap and water. But crucially, ensure any parts that will come into contact with the dry pesticide later are completely dry before you try to reuse the applicator. Moisture causes clumping and poor flow.
Got it. And granule spreaders.
Granule applicators also need inspection before use. Make sure there's no leftover residue in the hopper or blocking the metering mechanism. Check for blockages. Replace any worn or damaged parts. And make sure any gear covers are securely in place. They're important for protecting the moving parts from dirt and pesticide residue buildup.
Cleaning after use.
Yep. Empty them completely and wash them thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
Cold water is usually sufficient, but sometimes scrubbing or maybe hot water might be needed if there's buildup. You might fill the hopper with water and let it drain through the metering system to rinse it out. Be cautious with abrasive cleaners that could damage parts.
And lubrication.
Now, here's a specific detail the guide points out about granule applicators. You should lubricate only if the manufacturer specifically recommends it.
Oh, why is that?
The guide warns that applying too much grease, or greasing parts not designed for it, can actually increase the buildup of granule residue and dirt on the moving parts. That sticky mess can then cause wear or blockages, exactly the opposite of what you want. So follow the manual on lubrication for granule spreaders.
Interesting detail. Okay, lastly, chemigation equipment maintenance. Sounds complex.
It requires very diligent periodic monitoring of all its components, especially the critical safety features, things like the main pipeline check valve to prevent backflow into the water source, the vacuum relief valve, the low pressure drain, the chemical injection line check valve to prevent water flowing back into the chemical tank, the control panel, and those crucial safety interlock systems that are designed to shut everything down if there's a problem, like if the irrigation pump stops or the injection pump fails.
So lots of checks.
Lots of checks. Plus inspecting the irrigation and injection pumps themselves, and the power source. Repair or replace any damaged or worn parts immediately. And critically important, you must recalibrate the entire injection system. Any wait-time maintenance is performed, and any parts that could affect flow rate or pressure are replaced. Recalibration is key.
And flushing these systems is also vital.
Absolutely crucial, both for safety and effectiveness. After the chemical injection period is finished, you need to run the main irrigation system for at least 10 minutes to ensure all the remaining chemical is flushed out of the irrigation lines and onto the target area. For drip irrigation systems, because they have much lower flow rates, you might need to flush for significantly more than 10 minutes to clear the lines.
What if the system shuts down unexpectedly?
If the chemigation system shuts down automatically because one of the safety interlocks activated, you need to get it running again and flush it as soon as possible to prevent chemical from just sitting and potentially concentrating in the lines. If the shutdown was due to a malfunction or maybe loss of pressure that caused the chemical injection to stop, but the irrigation kept running for a while, the guide recommends flushing for at least 30 minutes as soon as the system is operational again, just to be sure everything is clear.
And the injection system itself needs flushing.
Yes. You should also flush the chemical injection pump, lines, and tank, if empty, with clean water after each use to prevent residue accumulation in that part of the system. The best way to do this is usually while the main irrigation system is still running for its final flush, so that the flush water from the injection system also gets applied to the target site.
Wow. This whole section on maintenance really drives home the level of, just attention to detail and sheer diligence that's required to use all this pesticide application equipment effectively, but maybe more importantly, safely. It's clearly a major responsibility.
It really is. It just reinforces that the equipment itself, its proper function, and the consistent care you give it are just as vital to a successful and safe application as choosing the correct product and getting the rate right. They go hand in hand.
So thinking back, we've journeyed from the sort of basic components of liquid application equipment. We delved into the specific nuances of recognizing wear and tear on different materials and parts, spent some dedicated time understanding the absolutely crucial role and surprising variety of nozzles. Mm. We explored that wide range of application methods and the specific equipment they require. And finally, we've detailed the indispensable maintenance needed to keep everything running safely and effectively.
Yeah, this deep dive really shows that being truly well-informed about something like pesticide application means you have to understand the tools of the trade, how they work, their specific limitations, their vulnerabilities to wear, how they need to be matched precisely to the task at hand, and how critical it is to care for them properly.
Yeah.
That machine putting the product where it needs to go, it's not just some simple delivery mechanism. It's an absolutely integral part of the entire process.
So what does this all mean for someone involved in this?
Well, I think it means the equipment isn't merely a delivery system. It's absolutely integral to achieving safety, achieving efficacy, and minimizing environmental impact. Proper selection of the right equipment for the chosen method, using it correctly, and performing diligent, specific maintenance are every bit as important as choosing the correct pesticide product and calculating the right application rate. You can't really separate them.
That's a great summary. Given the precision required that we've talked about, the technical knowledge needed just to manage wear and select the right components, and thinking about the potential environmental impact, does knowing all this maybe change how you view the role of the equipment operator? It really seems to highlight the significant skill and knowledge involved in actually getting this job done right, doesn't it?